Access number 29540, Mr. Norman Cole, Reel 8. Now, so what happens next then?
Well, the first thing
you get to Sarsted, there's this ammunition train that has exploded just before you get there.
Well, first thing I had to do was go out and reconnoiter and see just what the situation was. And it was dark then. So I had to go up, being very careful where I walked, of course, because there was live ammunition everywhere, to decide just where we would post men to protect it and keep people away from it. But we did just that. I got up through all right, of course, and decided where we would put up sentries to protect the area. It's as simple as that. Now, if simple's the right word.
Now, nearby there was this transit camp for forced labour, and that's probably why that first story was there. But anything else about the forced labour camp? Or did you have much to do with it?
No, not. There was just one that stuck in my mind. Was quite a. You couldn't call it a camp. It was more a compound in one place. I don't know if I got that in the notes even. And it was just full of tiered bunks. You could hardly move amongst them, behind barbed wire. And the thing I remember most of all, on the floor, there was piece of metal or bone that someone had tried to form into a comb to give themselves a little bit of sort of feeling of being human beings, to comb their hair. It was so crudely done that they'd actually tried to get a little bit of civilization into their situation. But there's no people there, and they'd probably been gone for some time.
Now, so what happens next then? You seem to be trying to remove all elements of Nazism.
Yes, we had an order to come through that we had to clear everything that related to the Nazi army, or maybe the Nazi itself, the German forces. And we used to pick a 1 kilometer square on the map. We'd give it a reference, then we'd say sort of, right, we're going to pick that kilometer square, we'll go there, and we'll check everything within that, check everything that's there, anything, any ammunition, any protection, any foxholes, anything at all, any insignia. And the one I chose for this particular day included a little village school. And we went up to this village school, which of course was unoccupied. But the school mistress lived in a house adjoining the school. So I went and got her out and went into the school. And around the wall, there were pictures on the wall of Nazi submarines and tanks and things like that. And I said to her, I must take those away with me. And she tried to talk to me. She was so frightened, she couldn't talk. It was something you hear about, and I'd actually seen it there. She was terrified. She was trying to talk to me and couldn't find a voice. So I had to calm her down for quite a long time and said, it's not a problem. I've just got to take them away. Nothing will happen to you. But, absolutely speechless with fear. That's what soldiers meant, I suppose, to some of the Germans still, you see. They just didn't know they knew what their own troops could be pretty tough, and they just didn't know what, we were an unknown quantity to them.
Anything else about clearing the signs of Nazism, German military?
No, I can't remember any others that we did. We did that one square, there was nothing else of importance in that particular kilometer square.
How did you react to the end of the war in Japan? I mean, was that a big relief to you? How did you feel?
No, didn't.
Don't remember. Didn't cross your mind?
No.
So what happened next then that you remember? There's something about coal trains. That's in Octo. After it's been divided into zones.
Zones, yeah.
You have these coal trains. You seem to be on one of them. Tell us about that.
Well, to get through to the British zone in Berlin, to get from the British zone itself, we had to go through Russian territory. the sector, the British sector and French and American sectors had to be supplied through Russian territory, and coal was something they needed badly. And the British authorities and the others obviously organized coal trains, trains full of coal, and they had to take them right through the Russian territory and deliver it into the British sector. And for each coal train, there had to be a guard to protect it, and there had to be some Royal Engineers who were responsible for controlling the engine driver and crew of the train. So we had nothing to do with the crew and the driver, but we were responsible for the train overall. And we were given a pass, which I've got in my notes, part half in Russian, half in English, to say that I had authority to take this coal train through Russian territory and deliver it into Berlin, which I did.
Anything happened? What?
Yeah, we spent the night there, and we thought we were there for a few days. And the loudspeaker in the hotel or whatever is where we were, the accommodation, suddenly said that all train crews could stand down except the train crew of Bombardier Cole and Bombardier Forbes. So we're the only two that couldn't. We were had to be prepared to bring an empty train straight back. And we had to get loaded up with food and so on for the journey back. And in fact, we landed up with two lots of food by mistake. We had food coming out the edge of the truck, I think. We got to the train, we got on it, went to one station, which was a little tiny place, part of Berlin, hardly any people there. And we went on and then into one of the main railway stations in Berlin, and that station was absolutely crowded with people. And somehow they knew that we were going back to the British sector, and they all started to get into the trucks. Well, there was me with about five soldiers. They keep about 3,000 or 4,000 people out of the trucks. It just wasn't possible. So I went up to the station master or someone in authority there and said, you know, obviously I couldn't keep them up, but would they realize that when they got to the edge of the Russian territory, I would have to give them up, then they'd be taken over by the Russians. Well, within a few minutes, it was being announced over the loud hailer that the train in this particular platform was going to Magdeburg or wherever it was. And the people got back on in force then, and I couldn't stop them. But there was one incident where a Polish fellow came up to... We had a truck, a covered wagon, really, which was enclosed. He came up, and I think he had a rifle in his... a revolver in his hand, and said he was going to travel with us in our truck. And I told him he wasn't, so he threatened me. So I turned my back on him, turned to my soldiers and told them to fix their bayonets. And when they did that, he ran. He disappeared. Where he went, I don't know.
Now, despite all that, did you take these hundreds of people back to the Russians? Or what did
Didn't
you...
have an alternative. They were just in open coal trucks. Back through the Russian zone they travelled. No one interfered to them whilst they were in the trucks.
Because in your memoirs you've got a story of sort of two young women being held back.
Oh yeah, but there's more than that. There's one of the soldiers went out, I don't know where he went actually, and he came back and said there was some, apparently a team of nurses out there. They wanted to get back to the British zone. Did we think we could help them? So being a mug, I suppose, I said, okay, we will. We'll let them in. So we let them in to our van and told them that, you know, they would, in effect, have to pretend they were British soldiers. Well, they did all the cooking for us. We gave up our beds and slept on the floor. They slept on our palliasses and that. And we got back.
So these were German nurses?
As far as we know, yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's the story we were told.
So, but why are these separate from the thousands that are on the train? I'm not quite clear what's happening.
Neither am I. I'm not quite sure. it came as a sob story, which we accepted, that they were sort of decent people trying to get back to the British zone where they belonged. And
but what I mean is, what difference does it make to have these two or three extra ones on board when you've got hundreds of them on board?
Not really.
Right.
Not a lot. It's just somebody to do the cooking. And
so they were in your part of the train as opposed to the open train?
Oh, yeah. They were in the covered coach.
Your
covered
bit and the rest of it. And, but it didn't make it. The Russians just let them through anyway.
Oh, they didn't stop anybody getting on the train until we got to the end of the journey. They didn't interfere with that train at all, much to my surprise.
And then what happened?
Everybody had to get turfed out.
Into the Russian zone?
Yeah, at the end of the Russian zone, yeah.
But not the ones in your bit?
Well, they said, who are they? And they said, well, they're British soldiers. And in the end, one of them, one of their officers, one very sure, so I don't know if I was involved or not, but surprising what a few cigarettes and a tin of bully beef could do. And they came through. And we got them through to the British zone then and set them up to a road and they went off. Goodness only knows what happened to them after that. One of them, incidentally, that I was talking to, she came from Cuxhaven. And she said, you know, if we, going back to Britain, going back to our own country, we sail from Cuxhaven across, which some troops did. She gave me her address. Well, I don't know what it is now. But so yeah. If I was going through, to call in and see her family.
So it looks to me like the account you've got written down here is from your letters from the time rather than from what you remember. Because it's much more detailed in the account.
Is it? Much. Yeah.
Okay. Now, there's another story about an armed, when you went on patrol on 31st of October 45, an armed raiding party was operating. You went out to try and stop them. Do you remember that?
Yes, but it didn't take up much time. These were raiding the local shops and so on, and businesses, taking advantage of the chaos that was there. And we were told to sort of bring this to order. So we got out. It was very cold, I remember, and we got dressed up. You wouldn't have thought we were soldiers at all, except we had arms with us. We had just had sort of heavy pullovers and two pairs of trousers and woolen hats and things like that to keep warm. But went out on patrol through the streets to see if we could pick up these armed raiders, but we never found them.
Now, anything else you remember about this period? That, well, there's two towns. The stories seem to be mixed between Dassel and Stassel, so, you know.
Stassel, yeah.
Anything else?
No, nothing comes to mind.
Now, what about the disbandment of the unit? Do you know when that happened?
Yes. Yes. We, in a sense, had not been a survey regiment, of course, for any time. We've been part of an army of occupation. But then we were formally notified we were an army of occupation, and the 9th Survey Regiment ceased to exist.
Now, roughly when was that?
In my clue. Offhand, I'm sorry, I don't know.
So what did you become then?
I've got the date. I can get the date.
Well, it looks like it might be January 46.
Could
that's
be.
That's when you change over your address, I presume. And what's your new? Your E Troop 58 Battery, 25th Field Regiment RA.
That's right, we got transferred to a field regiment.
Now, what were you doing with them?
Well, we became a part of them. One of the first things I had to do was go and sign for a piece of field artillery and all that went with it. And the person who was signing it over to me, he was handing up bits and pieces with technical names. It didn't mean a thing to me. I said, well, you can get me to sign anything. I said, you can hold up a bit of string and call it something, and I wouldn't know. He said, well, get your number one. Well, I didn't even know what a number one was then, but anyway, this is a senior member of the gun crew. He was an old sweat, long service man. Came along, and he knew everything inside out. And he came, and he sort of checked everything for me. He wouldn't accept the cover for the gun sight because he had his own and he'd brought his own and that was polished over years, but he wouldn't accept the dull one that was coming with the gun, so that had to go back and he put his own gun sight cover on there. And then I designed for this, and it included the gun, ammunition limbers, a quad to pull it, a half-track vehicle again. There was a jeep, and I think it was 14 soldiers, 14 gunners.
And what was your job? Or were you just an NCO?
I just had a gun with all that went with it, which I only had for a very short period of time, never ever used, never even got to know the crew properly. And the way they gave it to me, they took it outside, pushed it into a ditch and said, there's your gun, now, get it out.
Whereabouts in Germany were you with them? Do you know the town?
No.
Whereabouts near?
No, I don't know where we were at all.
So just Germany?
Yeah.
And what do you remember of your time with this unit? Obviously not.
Oh, only a few days. Only there a few days when the... What I remember about it was the thing that surprised me was sort of the hierarchy was so different.
In what way?
Well, there was strict borders between gunners and any NCO. Even the Lance Bombardier wasn't allowed to go into the quarters of the gunners. They weren't allowed to eat with them. They were the bottom rung. And when she got into the NCOs, they were sort of a next grade up till you got to the officers, and we had our own mess, and that separate from the gunners. Well, before we all mixed together like one. Very different, that. But I was only there a few days before my firm applied for a Class B release and got me out of the army.
So now tell me how you were demobilised.
Well, I was called to the office one day and said that my firm back in England, that I'd worked for before the war, made an application for me to be drawn out for a vital work at home in the country.
Now, when would this be? When were you demobilised, you remember?
No, are you moving into an area? See, I haven't got through my letters yet.
Okay.
I don't know that.
So what happened when you were demobilised?
Oh, very quickly, on a train. Got all my stuff together and taken to a station and on my way home.
Anything about the journey?
Was that when the dental mechanic?
I don't know.
I think it might have been the time when the dental mechanic was in the same coach as I was and was asleep in the night going through Holland and woke up. Said, where are we? He looked out and saw the name on the signboard. He said, oh, we're in Heron, are we? And went off. And all he looked at was the sign for Gent's Toilet. So he went home telling his folks he'd passed through Heron.
Now, what was the demob process like when you got back?
Very quick. I went to Woolwich Arsenal. Was there. Had to hand in things which no longer require rifle and so on. And then the place was replaced with a suit of clothes and some underclothes and given a railway ticket home.
Now, what we do is get you back into civilian life. What happened when you got back? What were you going to do? You'd been requested by employers. Did you go back to return in the same job, or were you promoted, or what happened when you got back?
Well, I went back to the same firm, but the firm was one of two which had been given this high priority work in Torquay. That was housing in Heal in Torquay, and there was a very large housing, I don't know, a few hundred prefabricated houses were going to be built there. So we had to build roads and sewers and all the services and that, and then build all the slabs and everything ready for these prefabricated buildings to be brought in. And what had happened, they'd had a...
So you were brought in as a building surveyor for that, were you?
I was brought in as a manager of the site. I was a site agent. What had happened, to avoid being thrown off the site for not having an agent there, they'd advertised and they'd got a major, somebody or other, who was a civil engineer, and he was in charge of the site as they started. And he was going out to East Africa as the... engineered the railway company there, and his date was coming up 3 or 4 months ahead, and they had to get somebody in position to take over when he was off to East Africa. So now, I had about 3 months with him, and he taught me a lot about civil engineering that I would need to know when I took over from him. And when he went, I was in charge of the site.
Tell me a bit about prefabricated housing, because that's obviously, the War Museum are quite interested in that, because it was a big thing after the war. What was prefabricated housing? How did it all work?
Well, the houses, there's two main types. One main type asbestos-based and one main type aluminium-based. And they were made in a factory in one whole unit. They had baths and everything installed, all complete. And all you needed was a concrete slab with the positions for water connection, sewer connection, and so on. And they brought these on huge trailers, then dumped them on the site, and people could move in. They were there ready for occupation right away.
And were they good? How, I mean,
people who lived on them were marvellous. They had things which most people didn't have. They had fridges. Hardly anybody had a fridge in those days. Washing machines built in. Oh, they were in heaven, people who moved into those.
And were there any problems, endemic problems? What sort of problems did they have?
I don't think there were any problems as such. No, it was very, very successful.
How long do you think they should have lasted for? Because there's still some now, aren't
there? Yeah, they did have a definite life, and I think it was about 20, 25 years, but they were obviously going to last longer than that. The manufacturers of them, the Bristol Aircraft Company, made some. And their representative was talking to me one day and said, now the war's over, we're going to set up show areas where we're going to have the different types of prefabricated buildings on display. People will come and say, oh, I have one of them. And they'll come and buy one on the spot, and it will be delivered. But I don't think it quite worked out like that.
Now, how did your war experiences affect you, do you think? Good, bad, different, physically, mentally? What effect do you think it had?
Oh, I think it developed my personality. I think I'd been rather cosseted in a one-child family and lived a very quiet, protected life. I think that drew me out. That turned me from being a young, quiet man into a very competent man.
So mentally it was very good for you.
It's very stimulating, I think.
Any problems as a result of your wartime, you know, physically and mentally?
No, I had no problems at all.
So for you, it was pretty positive. Are you in touch with your old comrades at all of the?
No, just before you get to comrades, can I say that the building site was very largely manned by German prisoners of war. They were doing most of the labouring. And
how did you get on with them?
Very well. In fact, I had three that I appointed for specific jobs, one of which became my personal assistant on the site. And we used to have a day, for my purposes, used to have a day in German and a day in English. He was a lovely man. He was an insurance clerk back in Germany. And I had letters from them after they were sent back.
So you got on
from all of them.
Were they good workers, reliable?
Yeah, oh yes. I had letters from them thanking me effusively for being so good to them, you know, being kind to them and so on.
Now, what about, are you a member of your regimental association or keep in touch with your old comrades?
Did for a while. Every first Thursday, I think it was, in October, we used to meet in a...
What was the association called?
Well, it wasn't. It was just members of the Night Survey Regiment. We met two or three times and then I lost contact with them then. I moved away from London and lost contact.
Are you in touch with any of them at all now?
No.
Thank you very much.